It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is off today. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's our weekly look at the behind the scenes of Congress with USA Today politics editor Paul Singer. First, we're getting a behind-the-scenes look at how Wisconsin's controversial voter ID law is playing out in federal court. On Friday, a three-judge panel reinstated Wisconsin's voter ID law. Now, election officials in the state say people who have already submitted absentee ballots will have to present their photo IDs for their votes to be counted. Then late on Tuesday, the American Civil Liberties Union filed an emergency appeal to the court's decision to put the law into place, saying the election is already underway. Kimmy King is here to explain how the law is being decided in the courts and what happens next. She's an associate professor of political science at the University of North Texas. Kimmy, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be here.
Well, what do you make of the move to implement this law less than 50 days before the next election here in the state?
It's actually a very bold move out of the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals to push the law forward and to simply say we're not going to hang around and wait for the appellate process to have worked and to have finalized, I should say, to have finalized that we need to move forward on this. This law has been around since 2011, and therefore we need to go ahead and start the process of implementation. And just because there may be some difficulties associated with it doesn't mean that we're going to delay it any further. It is a little bit surprising that, given that it's so close to the election, that they did push forward with it. But one of the things that you do see out of appeals courts is that they will move a case along and lift stays if they believe that their decision is going to withstand an appeal.
Interesting. Well, this was reinstated after a hearing from a three-judge panel. Why did it go to that three-judge panel first instead of the full court?
So one of the things that's interesting is it's this process of how cases get heard at the trial level and then at the court of appeal level. One of the things about voting rights cases is that they, and it's also the same reason that somebody could ask, well, why did the Wisconsin Supreme Court have this case and why is it in the federal courts and why are they looking to have the full panel hear the case? So understand that the federal voting rights guarantees are kind of a minimum floor that each state has to provide and can't go below in terms of violating some sort of right. But that being said, you have states which under the Constitution are allowed to regulate and monitor and actually are the ones carrying out elections. So you have this interaction between state and federal court, and because we're talking about federal civil rights and voting rights, there are different kinds of procedures that can be triggered that are actually written into the laws to provide additional protection. And so what the ACLU in filing this case is doing is it's trying to say, look, there is a provision for emergency appeals that when you get these kinds of cases to move for an expedited appeal so that we can resolve this issue or put the stay back on.
There was news breaking this morning that some 11,000 absentee ballots that had already been sent out, that those people who had already voted from that number would have to follow the new voter ID law, would have to present some form of ID along with that ballot. Why do those people who've already voted via absentee ballot have to follow the new law when it wasn't in place when they voted?
Well, this is going to be the issue on appeal, and certainly this is going to be part of the grounds of what the ACLU is going to try to argue. Part of the reason for why the court probably felt, the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals Court, I should say, we've got different kinds of opinions out there, but why the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals decision felt that it was probably okay to do that is because that in a prior case that had been heard in 2008, there had been this 2005 Indiana law that had upheld photo identification. And so what had wound up being upheld is that what the court said is that you can do a provisional ballot if you don't have the right identification. And as long as you come back in 10 days and give us the right identification, then you will have met the requirements and your provisional ballot can become a real ballot. What the Marion case says is, in essence, that there can be a little bit of additional hurdle that the states may place on people for getting that ID and to provide it. That is an altogether different question than what is presented by your Wisconsin voter ID issue. This is an implementation of a new rule where people don't have IDs. So the burden placed on persons trying to exercise what is considered to be a fundamental right will be much greater. And therefore, the ACLU is, I'm sure, going to try to argue that that burden, you know, interferes with basic federal civil rights.
So the ACLU has filed an emergency appeal on the voter ID decision. What should we expect to happen next with that?
So what's going to happen is, I believe that they have appealed to the full panel, and basically it's a way of saying, look, we think this Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals with these three judges, who everybody's talking about the fact that they're Republican judges, these three judges have 50 Republican judges, you know, 50 days before a major election in which in which Scott Walker is locked in a tight race. Let's be clear about the political stake that's involved in these cases, is attempting to try to put in place a law that will interfere and that the state is not ready for. And so that, I would imagine, is going to be the thrust of their argument.
How long should we expect that to take to get an answer on this latest appeal from the full court?
Part of it goes down to kind of paying attention to what the Seventh Circuit and the ideology and the political bent of the Seventh Circuit. So a lot of the court watchers are going to be trying to, you know, point out, and they're going to be looking back at this Crawford versus Marion County Election Board, because, you know, there again, you had a Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, and both the District Court and the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals had upheld the law, right? This is a very different set of circumstances than what was presented in that case. So part of it's going to depend on the extent to which within the Seventh Circuit there are these divides that, now, this is a different case from what we were looking at in the Indiana law, and we need to take that into consideration because we are going to have people that had already exercised their right to vote under a different law, and, or, you know, the law prior to have it been put back in place, and now their votes will, in essence, be disenfranchised. Now, the Seventh Circuit might carve it out, and here's another thing to watch for. They might say those that have already voted, it is a lawful vote because the law at the time was that you did not need to have the voter ID. So this kind of crazy scheme of making people go turn in their identification after the fact, yeah, that interferes with the, you know, the fundamental right that you have to vote. However, for those going forward, because we find that this is a valid law and we find that it is legitimate to have this kind of voter ID, you are going to have to provide it. Now, what about those folks that don't have the voter ID? And that's where we're going to have to watch and see what the Seventh Circuit, how they view that, because that is the issue that is not so clear.
So those are some of the issues that we'll be watching. But how likely do you think it is that the voter ID law will still be in place for the November 4th election?
Wow, I wish I knew. I could make a lot of money predicting these things. I will tell you, as a general rule, we've seen the growth of voter identification laws spread across the country. I'm down here in Texas, and our voter ID law continues to have, you know, challenges, but it's currently in place. We have one of the most restrictive voter identification laws. And if you look across the country, increasingly states are putting in place voter identification laws. Now, certainly not as many, you know, are doing what Texas has done, because we have a fairly restrictive one. But states are enacting those, and the general trend seems to be for supporting reasonable voter identification regulations. Now, what constitutes reasonable? This is what the court's going to get into. Is it reasonable to require that persons who might not otherwise have the appropriate voter identification be required to go out and get those 50 days before the election? Because remember, your Department of Motor Vehicles can run like a 2-3 month wait on being able to get driver's license or photo identifications. And so those kinds of delays and the ability of the ACLU to point to those are the kinds of things that are going to militate in favor of keeping the stay on for this election. The long-term prognosis, that's just for this short-term one. So I think the likelihood in this case, if I had to place a bet, I would say that I think that they might do something that limits the scope of that Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals decision. Then you still have the long-term issue of can Wisconsin have a voter ID? And I think that where the courts are going with this is that they are going to uphold voter IDs.
Okay, we'll be watching and so will you. Kimmy, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Kimmy King, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of North Texas, talking about Wisconsin's voter ID law and how it could play out in court. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert, and it's time for our weekly look at Congress with USA Today politics editor Paul Singer. The House is voting today on President Obama's plan to combat the Islamic State movement. It's an amendment to a bill that will also fund the federal government through December. And for years, the U.S. Senate has been following a secret set of rules that describes how they can and cannot spend taxpayer dollars, among a bunch of other things. The official Senate guidebook was obtained by USA Today and published earlier this week. We'll hear about that. Paul Singer takes us behind the scenes with his commentary on Congress every week at this time. Hey, Paul, how's it going?
Going so far so good. And yourself, Veronica?
It's going pretty well, thanks. Well, I want to start with this House vote today.
Yeah.
It's apparently not an authorization of military force against ISIS or ISIL. What exactly is it?
Right. It is very clearly not an authorization of military force. Congress is authorizing the administration to arm and train Syrian rebels. This is the group that we had wanted to arm. The Obama administration wanted to arm these folks to fight against Syrian President Assad. Now they want to arm and train them to help fight against ISIL or ISIS or the Islamic State. So what they're saying is that you may now officially, formally begin training and arming these fighters. They are not saying that we may launch a war in Syria, and they are not saying that we can introduce U.S. ground troops in the area. That continues to be off the table, and Obama said again today that he is not planning to send ground troops. That is not part of his strategy.
Now, is this vote actually necessary to U.S. action, or is this a formality?
The Pentagon has said this is necessary. They have been using back channels to get weapons to the Syrians, but they needed an actual public declaration to allow them, they needed a law passed to allow them to legally, publicly engage, basically, have the Defense Department directly engage with the Syrian forces there. Keep in mind, this is also a temporary measure. Because it's attached to this short-term spending bill, it only extends through December, so Congress will have an opportunity to sort of revisit this whole issue then to see whether they are getting what they expected out of it.
Well, is there anyone right now in Congress who's saying, you know, hang on a second, this is tantamount to military force, so we should have a vote about that?
Yeah, you've got a number of people sort of raising the issue of whether we should be involved at all. I mean, I think it was Loretta Sanchez of California today in the House saying, you know, if you start to engage in something like this, we're going to have American troops there doing the training, and sooner or later we're going to be involved in the ground war. It's just sort of the next, it's kind of a slippery slope argument. You will find, I think, some conservative Republicans and some liberal Democrats agreeing that this is not a good idea, specifically because it basically reintroduces American forces into the conflict, and they're very much afraid of what that might lead to. But they're going to be outnumbered. I think this vote is going to be a pretty one-sided in the House in favor.
Is there any conflict here in the sense that the Republican-controlled House would be giving the president, you know, kind of what he wants heading into fall elections?
Well, yeah, except that I think the Republicans feel that in some ways this was their agenda in the first place. And the Republicans have been saying all along that we needed a more forceful policy in Syria and in the area, a more forceful reaction to the Islamic militants. To some degree, this is Republicans endorsing Obama's strategy, which is not far from what the Republicans wanted in the first place. Whether or not this is good, keep in mind, for either party going to November campaigns, it's hard to really tell. I'm not sure that the American public's going to be all that excited about more forceful military action in the Middle East again. So there's some question about who this is really good for on a political ground. But I think the leadership, both parties, Democrats and Republicans in the Congress, have said, we just need to do this. It's clear this ISIL group is a threat, and the American military needs to engage them in some way.
Now, briefly before we move on, you are hearing some voices now calling for boots on the ground in some fashion, including Senator Ron Johnson from Wisconsin, who said so on Central Time a few weeks ago. How big a deal is that?
Well, I mean, again, this is the slippery slope argument, right? I mean, the fact of the matter is, at the moment, there are, I think, 1,500 U.S. military personnel on the ground in Iraq, helping to protect American facilities or American personnel or critical Iraqi facilities, helping to train the military there. I mean, the fact of the matter is, we're on the ground. What the issue is going to be is if one of those people, God forbid, is killed, or if there was an attack on American forces there, do we begin to introduce more troops? And this is where the slippery slope argument comes, that, you know, sooner or later, there probably are going to be American boots on the ground, or at least there's going to be somebody's boots on the ground. It's a question of whether America is training and equipping them, or is in fact providing the troops.
So moving on, USA Today unveiled some interesting news earlier this week about what has been apparently guiding the administration behind the scenes in the Senate for a long time. It seems like it's sort of skull and bones for the Senate.
Yeah.
What is this guidebook you got a hold of?
You know, I'm really embarrassed by this one because I've covered congressional ethics for years. And we've talked about all, you know, in the House, there's a handbook that basically describes what you're allowed to and not allowed to do when spending your office accounts. That is, a taxpayer-provided account for running your congressional office.
To the tune of millions of dollars.
Yeah, it's $2 to $4 million a year per senator. In the House, this book is public. It's on their website. You can read it, and it tells you what you can and cannot do. In the Senate, every time we've gotten to one of these things, we've had to ask someone to send us a copy of the rules, or where are the rules, and we can never really find the thing. Finally, it dawned on me that I could get someone to just leak me the whole book, and they did. This thing has never been public. The committee that prints the thing wouldn't release it. The government printing office that prints it wouldn't give it to me. We're like, what do you mean this thing is secret? These are the rules you live by. How can it be secret? I'm like, well, we don't release it because it has some security information regarding the Congress, which is true. There are 10 pages about basically what do you do if there's a bomb threat. And again, it's written for Senate staff and senators on how you run your office. So there is some stuff about security and how to get an ID badge and stuff like that. But we thought it was absurd that this thing had never been public. And I was frankly embarrassed that I had never before just tried to have someone give it to me. Now we have it. We post it on the website. Everybody can look at it.
Which is quite a coup, considering the Library of Congress doesn't even have a copy of it.
What was
the most surprising thing in the book?
Oh, I don't know. The most surprising thing about it is how Byzantine the United States Senate is. I mean, once again, you forget that they have rules for how many potted plants a senator can borrow from the botanic gardens. They have rules for how many pieces of paper you are allocated as a senator. 1 1/3 sheets for each adult constituent. I mean, you know, it's the stuff that could have come straight out of the Central Committee of the Soviet Union in the 1930s. You know, it's just so completely Byzantine and bureaucratic. It's just wildly entertaining.
So is the takeaway here that now we know a little bit more about what's allowed ethically when you senators are spending money, taxpayer money, running their offices?
Yeah, and where the sort of rubber hits the road here is we came to this book this time around because we've been studying how senators are using charter flights, using taxpayer money to pay for charter flights. And what we discovered is a bunch of the lawmakers chartering aircraft to travel around the state, which is legitimate. But we want to see the rules for how and when they're allowed to. And in fact, what happened after that, after we started writing those stories, we began to discover several senators had been paying for trips with taxpayer dollars that were not proper. They were, in fact, campaign trips, not official trips, and they should have been paid for out of the campaign. Now that this book is public, anybody can follow a member of Congress's travel, see where they are, and go look it up in the book. Does this fit the rules of something that should be funded by the taxpayer, or is this something that should not be funded by the taxpayer? That's the kind of stuff this rule book tells you, and I think it's important that the voter is able to look at it and say, hey, I think my senator is doing something that is not within the rules.
Well, congratulations on getting a hold of it, Paul, and some little light reading there if people want to go to bed.
300 pages of fun.
So we'll talk more about another story we didn't get to, hopefully next week. Paul, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Veronica. Have a great day.
We've been speaking with USA Today politics editor Paul Singer. He joins us every week at this time to keep us up to date on what's going on in Congress. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is off. Coming up, we'll find out why America's weather satellites might be in trouble. But first, you may not immediately think of ping pong when the world of international diplomacy comes to mind, but our guest today traces a surprising history that links the two subjects. Nicholas Griffin says the game of ping pong has a long history of political intrigue. His book is called Ping Pong Diplomacy, The Secret History Behind the Game That Changed the World. Nicholas, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, ping pong doesn't always seem like a sport of huge consequences when you compare it with some other high-profile games. But according to you, it does have an incredibly rich political history. Where did the idea to use ping pong as a political tool come from?
It actually came from the man who actually sat down and wrote the rules to the game. It had had this sort of brief burst of popularity in the late 19th century, but then it faded and died until this very wealthy young aristocrat came along and sat down and wrote the rules for the game. But what no one knew was that he was, the same year he wrote the rules for the game, he started working for the Soviet Union secretly as a spy and actually worked for them in one form or another all the way through the rest of his life.
It seems like a pretty revolutionary idea. So how did he get from, you know, being a spy to thinking, hey, this ping pong thing, I could do something with this?
Well, the first part of the Soviet Union who sort of had him on the payroll, not that he, actually that's not fair because he wasn't actually paid, but it was called the Comintern, which is short for the Communist International. And their mandate was to sort of impregnate Western culture with communist ideas and in any way, shape, or form. So they tried to use absolutely everything. He was a filmmaker as well. He actually produced all of Alfred Hitchcock's early spy movies, not that Hitchcock knew he was a spy. But sport was another obvious sort of cultural medium through which he could contact a very large group of people.
So he could reach large groups of people with ping pong, but it's still, you know, people playing table tennis together. What's incendiary or revolutionary about introducing ping pong?
Well, the point for him was to then create an international table tennis federation, which he could start use to tying countries together around the world who didn't necessarily have diplomatic relations. Now, you know, obvious moments would be such as the Iron Curtain. He could move in and out behind the Iron Curtain without any questions being asked. That meant he could certainly, you know, being a courier wasn't an issue. Taking meetings all over the place wasn't an issue. And then it sort of got more and more serious once he got the Chinese involved.
Did he actually have a love of the game alongside all of the political intrigue?
No, his love of the game goes right the way back to a table he made his father buy in their vast mansion in Kensington, London, back in the sort of around 1914. His ping pong was as one of his deep loves right up there alongside communism.
It's an unusual match, isn't it? And it did find a home in China. Why did it catch on so easily there?
Well, the good thing for this man, the Honorable Ivor Montagu, was that it was fertile ground. So when he took the game and offered it to Mao and Zhou and Premier Zhou Enlai in 1950, within 3 weeks of the foundation of the People's Republic of China, it turned out they both already loved the game. They used to play during bombing raids of Chiang Kai-shek on sort of the communist enclave in Yan'an.
Wow.
Zhou Enlai and Chairman Mao used to sit in a cave together playing a game of ping pong.
Ping pong. That's a surreal thought.
I know. But so when he arrives in 1950 and offers it to them, you know, he's already offered to many countries, including the Soviet Union, who are not quite that enthused as the idea of ping pong as a national sport. But in China, they leap on it.
And so it took root there, and it became something that was played across the nation, and they began to pride themselves on ping pong, it sounds like. How did it catch on?
Well, the good news is if you're the Chinese government and you want to do something top-down, the whole state structure was set up that way. So they copied a lot of the Soviet structures. And it was, you know, very much in order from above. So, you know, they'd start looking for players in school playgrounds. Then you'd be sent to sort of night school for ping pong, then it would be a sort of sports school for ping pong, then you'd be picked up by your city team, and then you'd be scooped up by the national team. So it was all highly structured.
Wow, that's fascinating.
But they had these vast competitions, you know, trying to get millions of people involved, because the idea was that not that they wanted to play the sport, but that they wanted to win an international competition for the first time and show that modern China was strong. Now, ping pong was an odd way to do it, but they knew they had a very good friend in Ivan Montague and they'd be protected, whereas they knew that things like the Olympics and the Soccer's World Cup were very much driven by Western democracies who they still didn't trust.
Well, it's interesting that they latched onto ping pong in a way because, you know, ping pong gets dismissed a lot of the time as being, you know, sort of table tennis light and tennis light, I should say. And, you know, some people think, what is there to it? It's kind of a kid's game, but you can get pretty virtuosic on it.
Yeah. No, I mean, it doesn't carry a lot of weight in the rest of the world. That's totally fair to say. But, you know, that ends up being to China's strength when we get a little deeper into this story, the fact that no one else was really paying attention to it. But there, it was sort of just this first way for them to get their foot on this sort of, for what they considered international respect, and to show that they were no longer, you know, the sick man of China, which is how they'd been painted since the 1840s.
So at one point in 1961, ping pong was more than a recreation or a point of national pride. It was those things too, in a way, but it was also used to cover up a horrible famine where millions of people died. Can you tell us how ping pong was used in China then?
Yeah, I mean, you get this moment called the Great Leap Forward in the late 50s in China. And the idea here is that China's going to industrialize super rapidly, they're going to overtake Great Britain steel production. They're going to overtake American grain production. But they have some very bad ideas that this is based on. One of those is the close planting of seeds, that seeds are like good communists, and if you put a whole lot together, they'll help each other grow. Now, of course, anyone who's ever done any farming knows that seeds will fight just like animals will, and everyone's fighting for light and water, and that they'll all die. So you have these horrible crop failures across China, along with several other factors, and it combines to make this incredible famine. And that famine kills, depending on Chinese statistics, say 17 million. The latest statistics done by a professor in Hong Kong say 44 million. The numbers are just extraordinary. And during that time, Ivan Montague, the head of the International Table Tennis Federation, the Soviet agent, brings them this sort of one ray of hope, and that's, would China like to host the World Table Tennis Championship in 1961? So coming towards the end of the famine here, they have this chance for this propaganda show to show that everything is absolutely fine in China. So they bring in foreign players, foreign officials, foreign journalists, and they set up this sort of Potemkin village situation where they get everybody in and out without a single crumb of knowledge of what's really happening in China leaking out of the country.
So it works. The ping pong ruse works.
It worked. It was so sort of benign in a way, which was what was so wonderful, and what the Chinese began to realize that it's rather, you know, it's rather a disarming sport. How on earth are you going to think of ping pong as political? And yet it was.
And the next big event that you profile, they'd already used it to great success in that case, but in 1971, 10 years later, it gets used again in another high-stakes gambit between the U.S. and China, who are having trouble coming together. How did ping pong enter into the picture there?
Well, you had this fascinating moment where it looks like the leadership of both respective countries have sort of figured out how to communicate alone. So in other words, Nixon and Kissinger have reached out without the State Department's knowledge, and Mao and Zhou Enlai have reached out without anyone else's interference. And you get this very slow motion back channel opening up in which handwritten notes are sent around the world in diplomatic pouches. And it's going very slowly, but it's pretty steady until the American side misses a grand signal. And that signal was that Chairman Mao put a left-wing American journalist standing on his right during a parade. Now, we missed that. We didn't understand that was part of this game that we were playing. So that meant that we didn't respond. So suddenly you had this chasm opening up again. And it had been 22 years since any serious conversation had gone on. So the Chinese needed to come up with a statement so obvious, so political, that everyone was going to get it. And the method they chose was this game of ping pong.
And just introduce us to the match a little bit. And it got some news coming up in about 30 seconds. What were those first moments like?
The whole thing swirls around this relationship of two young men. One is an American hippie called Glenn Cowan, and the other is the best player in the world, a three-time world champion called Chuang Tse-Tung, and they're very, very different characters.
We're talking with Nicholas Griffin. He's the author of Ping Pong Diplomacy, The Secret History Behind the Game That Changed the World. And we're hearing the story of the 1971 match that brought the U.S. and China together. More of that conversation coming up in a moment, but first, here's a check of the latest headlines from Kristen Durst in the WPR newsroom. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret returns tomorrow. We're listening back to an interview we did with Nicholas Griffin. He's the author of the book Ping Pong Diplomacy, The Secret History Behind the Game That Changed the World. And we're hearing the story of a 1971 ping pong match that brought together the U.S. and China. And Nicholas, let's go back to that match in 1971. It took place in China, and the U.S. folks went over there. What was the scene like when they arrived?
Well, I mean, they were really the first big group of any consequence to enter Americans to enter China in 22 years. So most, when you talk to most of the players, many compared it to sort of stepping onto the surface of the moon. So little was known about China at that time. A lot of the people who studied it in the State Department compared it more to astrophysics to diplomacy. So everything was new, and everything was very strange. And for instance, the first big game, they're in the largest ping pong stadium in the world. It holds somewhere between 18 and 20,000 people, bigger than, you know, Madison Square Garden when it's playing a basketball game. But the big difference for these American players, who've rarely played in front of even 500 people, is that every single member of that crowd happens to be a member of the People's Liberation Army, all wearing the same thing. I mean, talk about a culture shock.
And the American star that you were talking about, he was a character. Talk a little bit about what it was like for him as he kind of went around in China and met people.
Yeah, he was certainly the first hippie ever to enter China. So any wonders with his sort of purple bell-bottom trousers and his yellow floppy hat and this white T-shirt with covered in peace signs saying, "Let it be." And, you know, he's actually having a wonderful time because he's just decided to be himself. And, of course, the press members who've been allowed to go suddenly realize that this is the man to sort of build the story around. So you get this sort of bizarre symbiotic relationship between Glenn Cowan and the press, where it's very obvious that he's going to be the one they turn to because it's just a great story, an American hippie in communist China during the Cultural Revolution. It's just too good.
And it sounds like he made no secret of the fact that he didn't, you know, mind getting high now and then, and there were some surreal moments in the media.
Yeah. He'd promised that he'd sort of thrown his stash away before he crossed the border, but apparently he hadn't. He took it in with him and was wandering around high as a kite half the time. I mean, it's an extraordinary thing to think of. I mean, most of the people on that team were feeling this pressure of being turned from sort of athletes into sort of accidental diplomats overnight, and yet here he is, cool as a cucumber, just doing his thing as if he was back in his hometown of Los Angeles.
So what was that championship match like? How did the American game stack up against the Chinese game?
Well, the wonderful thing for the Chinese is they were by far the best team in the world, and the Americans, I think, finished that year ranked 28th. So they were in control of everything.
So it wasn't the match of the century.
It was not the match of the century, but the Chinese made it exciting. They threw a few games here and a few games there, and, you know, they got... But it's not as if they could get the crowd going, because the crowd were made up of soldiers. So the crowd got going when the lights flashed to tell the crowd to get going. It was a very, very controlled atmosphere. But, you know, the really extraordinary thing, which the American players didn't know at the time, was how this was playing outside of China. Of course, inside of China, it's state-controlled press. It was sort of kept relatively quiet. But this thing spread like wildfire around the world. And Glenn Cowan was front-page news from the day he walked across and entered into China.
And what did that change for America and China?
It changed everything. I mean, the extraordinary thing was the first polls that were taken a couple of weeks after the Americans came back from China. Previously, the feeling of the American public was pretty much anti-China, anti-communist, as it had been for a long time. And yet, within 2 weeks, you've got that poll, which now reveals a majority of Americans favor communist China being accepted into the UN, which then, of course, goes ahead and happens that year. And what this maneuver of, you know, this highly meticulous strategy in China of creating this sort of ping-pong moment, it's provided this enormous political breathing space for both Kissinger and Nixon and Mao and Zhou Enlai to take their time and to sort of get things organized. And that leads to Henry Kissinger appearing on a secret mission that July in Beijing, and then the president himself. Nixon rolls into town in February of the next year, in 72.
So they really opened the floodgates in a way.
They did. And actually, if you look at it, I mean, one of the early things you learn about negotiating in the arena of international relations is that, you know, the three most important things are location, location, location. And here the Chinese, who are by no means a strong nation at that time, the most populous nation, but not by far from the strongest, they have managed to get ping-pong diplomacy to happen in Beijing. They've managed to persuade Kissinger, who was willing to meet anywhere, to come to Beijing. And they've managed to convince President Nixon to come to Beijing. And that, in Beijing, is where they create the Shanghai Communique, which is the first new document in this new relationship.
Do you think this would have worked if it were a different sport? I'm imagining, for instance, American football. If they'd invited Americans to come over and play football, I can't imagine the American public would have been so kindly disposed to be trounced at football in China, and that it would have been this moment of acceptance. What is it about ping pong that opened the door?
Well, I think it played perfectly from both sides. So to the Chinese, it let them feel as if they were always going to be the better team. They were in this position of power. They could throw games. The Chinese public would understand that. And from the American side, it was, you know, ping pong is this benign sport that supposedly belongs in basements and fraternity houses. So to us, it totally humanized the Chinese. It's like, you know what, these guys aren't sort of eating babies for breakfast. They're ping pong players, just like us. You know, what could be more harmless?
But they were incredible ping pong players. I've seen some shots of the Chinese players from that game, and it doesn't look like, you know, a fluffy sport. It looks like these guys are real athletes.
Oh no, I mean, it was taken tremendously seriously over there. These guys were, I mean, they had the same regimen every day. They were lifting weights, swimming, marching through snow. I mean, you name it. It was
for ping pong.
For ping pong. I mean, it seems preposterous, but that's how seriously it was taken over there.
And so what is the legacy of that moment? Has it been used again, and is it something that really deserves to go down in the annals of diplomatic history?
I mean, I think it does, because it's just this absolutely unique moment. I think itself, the problem with it, I think, is that it sets a false precedent in that you have people wanting to check out basketball diplomacy and you know, wrestling diplomacy, and all these other things have been tried. But here you had something very peculiar going on, and that was that just before ping pong diplomacy takes place, you have this political goodwill forming out of the blue. And it's secret, so nobody knows it's happening. You know, no, it's not covered by any press or newspaper. This framework that Nixon and Mao are creating between them, so that ping pong diplomacy is interpreted absolutely correctly and timed perfectly, and very much warmly accepted in the White House. I mean, it shocked the White House. They were very surprised when it came along. Kissinger was a little worried that it was going to upset all his back-channel shenanigans. But Nixon, within 24 hours, his favorite question to anyone entering the White House is, have you learned to play ping pong yet? He got it immediately.
Wow, then that's a picture, too, Nixon playing ping pong. I can't do it. So did a lot of people want to play ping pong after this happened? Did it take off?
Yeah, it had a brief burst of popularity, and unfortunately for Glenn Cowan, the American hippie, he thought that he was going to ride that ping-pong ball to fame and riches. And, you know, everything was wonderful for about a month, and he's on every chat show across America. He's with Johnny Carson, you name it, he's doing it. But then, of course, the sort of bubble bursts, and ping-pong returns to the basement, and poor Glenn Cowan is sort of set adrift.
Well, Nicholas, thank you so much for joining us. It's a great story.
Thank you very much for having me.
That was Nicholas Griffin. He's a journalist and the author of the book Ping Pong Diplomacy, The Secret History Behind the Game That Changed the World.